Hi, everyone. The Odd Years is brought to you by the Cook Political Report, and we're excited that we'll be back in 2025 with a brand new season. We started the Odd Years in 2023, which was both a literal odd-numbered year, but also a political odd year, a year when there were no national elections. But I so enjoyed these conversations that we kept going into 2024, which is, of course, an even year. But that doesn't really roll off the tongue like odd years does. Anyway, now that we are headed back into another odd year, the year 2025, we're excited to continue the podcast. As many of you have noted, our title has a few layers of meaning. Odd describes so much happening in our world now, and we'll get into that too. What's making the times we live in interesting, unpredictable, surprising, and my guests will include people who live and breathe politics, well, like me, and plenty who do not. So be sure to follow us. We'll be back soon in the new year. But for now, enjoy our final show of 2024. Hello, I'm Amy Walter. Welcome to The Odd Years. We're bringing you a conversation we recorded a couple weeks ago with my colleague David Wasserman and the two pollsters who collaborated with the Cook Political Report team on our 2024 Swing State project. We started the project in the spring of 2024 in order to get a deeper understanding of the issues, concerns, and priorities of voters in the seven key battleground states. We teamed up with two amazing pollsters, Patrick Toomey, partner at the Democratic firm BSG, and Greg Strimple, president of GS Strategy Group, a Republican polling company. What I really loved about working with Greg and Patrick and their teams is that these are campaign pollsters. They understand the dynamics involved, not just in what voters are saying, but also how candidates and campaigns would respond to them. We conducted three surveys with Greg and Patrick, one in May, one in August, right after Kamala Harris replaced Joe Biden on the top of the ticket, and a final one in September. You can, by the way, find all of those at cookpolitical.com. The one consistent theme we saw throughout those three polls was that voters' concern about the state of the economy and inflation dominated, even as events like Biden's last minute dropping out and an assassination attempt on Trump roiled the campaign. So I started this conversation with Dave, Greg, and Patrick by asking, even though Kamala Harris was able to narrow the gap on economic issues from where Joe Biden stood earlier in the year, in the end, was this simply, it's an economy stupid election? Greg Strimple answered first.
It was certainly an election that was about change. And the two big pieces I thought that were driving the change conversation were cost of living, inflation. I think it's distinct from the economy, just in my own thinking on that, but also immigration. And I think that Kamala Harris, you referenced the fact that she closed numbers on the economy. Basically, she brought Democrats home, and so she improved on the economy. But that was always kind of her weakest place to battle on. And I was surprised that they decided strategically that's where they needed to go.
First, Patrick, let me have you weigh in about the economy and also sort of talk to this point that Greg brings up about whether focusing as much as they did, both the Harris campaign, but also the super PACs, on trying to narrow this gap on the economy, was that the right way to go? Or should they have spent much more time talking about Donald Trump himself?
Yeah, look, I think they were between a rock and a hard place in terms of answering that question, because to me, one thing this election makes clear, and I wish had been more obvious to Democrats in the years ahead of this election, was just how much of a problem we face with voters believing we don't care about or prioritize the economy. I actually don't think the problem for Democrats is that voters disagree with much of our economic agenda. I've done extensive polling on policy items that test off the charts with voters, including in red states. I've passed minimum wage expansions in places like Missouri and Nebraska. We can win voters with democratic economic policy, including very center-right and Republican voters. But what I hear really consistently from voters, particularly when I conduct qualitative research and focus groups, is that they don't think Democrats care about the economy. Not that we're wrong on the economy, but we prioritize the preferences of activists and donors and elites over the things, the kitchen table issues that matter most to people. So they don't trust that we're going to deliver on the economy, even if they like much of the Democratic Party's agenda on the economy, then at least its historical agenda. So I think that the party needed to and continues to need to work on rebuilding trust in the party on economic issues, and that's what our focus is going to be, not just that we're the party that's going to raise wages or we're the party that's focused on lowering costs, but like we're the party that's going to commit to doing that above all else and not get distracted by other issues that voters believe we're distracted by. I do think that more could have been done to undermine Trump as a leader. And I think that in the closing days, Democrats went about doing it in the wrong way. I think there was too much focus on he's a threat to democracy. He's attacking Puerto Rico, really focusing on how Trump is offending institutions that voters don't have a great deal of trust in, or portions of the population that just simply aren't large enough to deliver a victory for Democrats. I think the way we went about this in 2020 was much better. I think often back to Michelle Obama's line from 2020 about he simply cannot be the person we need him to be. We did not connect voters' belief that Trump is erratic and dangerous and extreme to harming them personally. It was consistently about how he's going to be offensive to different groups of people, or how he will undermine institutions. Not this means he will not be able to improve your life and will actually make your life worse.
Well, I want to get deeper into that question with both of you, because one of the consistent themes from our polling this year was that about a third of the swing state electorate were true Trump believers. They liked both him, his policies, and then you had another almost half of the electorate, somewhere in the 45 to 48% range, that didn't like Trump or his policies. And that meant that neither candidate could win with just their base. They needed to win over the 17 to 22% of people that said they disliked Trump personally, but liked his policies. And it was like, trying to find a needle in a haystack to find a double lover, not just a double hater. But Greg, do you think the Harris campaign could have gone about this a different way? And you've made clear throughout the cycle, you believe that Harris needed to spend more time making this a character argument about Trump and in going less in depth or trying to make it about making his policies unacceptable. But putting on hypothetically the other side's hat, what would you have done, and could it have made a difference?
I think that's a great question, David. You're right that the swing group in this election were the people who liked Trump's policies but did not like him personally. And they were disproportionately folks in the suburbs. They were disproportionately independent voters. They were disproportionately women. And, you know, one of the big things that I was paying attention to this year is like battle of the gender gap, right? As the men were going further and further towards Trump, women were going further and further towards Harris, who was going to win that battle? And those people, particularly women, were torn. And, you know, that's why you had this late breaking race on whether they were disliked how Trump was going to approach the presidency from a dispositional standpoint, or they were really intrigued by what he was going to do in terms of cost of living or immigration. And what I thought the mistake was from Kamala Harris's campaign is they engaged him on a conversation on the economy, on immigration. She went to Arizona to say, hey, I'm not so bad on immigration. And the piece that Trump did so well is he made it all about her being liberal and bad on the economy, bad on immigration, for other people, not for the working class. And she kind of completely failed to recognize where the opportunity was for her to be successful.
And I know, Patrick, you laid out kind of a more concise character argument about connecting voters' pre-notions about Trump's extremism and erratic behavior to how it could harm voters. But Greg, is there something that you have in mind that the Harris campaign could have done to connect those dots?
I thought that Patrick made really good points on that. And when we looked at it, there was the issue of him being a felon. There was an issue of him targeting his political enemies. The retribution kind of feel that instead of, to again, to Patrick's point, that he was going to spend the next 4 years punishing his enemies rather than fixing problems at the for the kitchen table. I thought all those were great opportunities for her. And I thought that the biggest strategic fail of the campaign is she won the debate. And she won the debate because she made it about him personally. And the campaign was caught flat-footed. And so they continued to do the advertising on the economy, all this stuff, instead of saying, oh my God, we were onto something. She was onto something. Maybe we can go catch lightning in a bottle. And I thought that that was a big failure for her.
Patrick, what do you think about that piece of it in terms of just, you started off by saying the campaign was in between a rock and a hard place, and there's no doubt about that. But was there any other opportunity that they had with these voters, especially those in the swing states that we saw who were undecided? Many of them were women, many of them were voters of color, younger, that would have resonated. Would that character message have resonated better?
Look, I think that there were ways, like I said, to improve upon that character message. I think finding ways to connect it to harm to you, the voter, and not like this abstract, this isn't what, politics should look like, and we need to protect institutions and norms in Washington, D.C. Most people are not very happy with how things are working in Washington, D.C. So, saying that Trump is going to upend all of that and that's the reason to oppose him, I think actually backfires. I also think with younger voters, and I know that there's been some, certainly anecdotal stories emerging about this and a little bit of research. A lot of those voters don't particularly remember, because of their age, what the first Trump administration was like. They don't viscerally associate it with chaos and things being erratic. I remember reading a quote from someone somewhere who said, everyone said it was impossible, but here I am alive. We survived the first Trump administration, so it can't actually have broken the world. One of the numbers from our, it comes from our May poll that I just think speaks to the what I do think was an insurmountable challenge for Harris was 62% of voters when we asked in May said they approved of the job Trump did on the economy when he was in office. I mean, that is just off the charts. The flip, it was a mirror image of Biden's numbers at the time, where 60% disapproved of the job he was doing. I think that was a type of headwind at a point where voters' top concern was the economy by far. 73% saying that that was one of their top three issues in that same May survey, compared to just 35% saying abortion was one of their top three issues, Harris's best topic. Like I said, I think that there are really important lessons from this election for Democrats going forward and how we can improve. It is not clear to me that any one of these things is something that was going to change the outcome for Harris.
I mean, I think that's such a great point, that 62% number, because again, if we want to play, choose your own adventure here, in some ways, if you're Republicans, you say, well, maybe this could have been an easier win for a traditional Republican who didn't come with the baggage of Donald Trump. He made it a lot closer than it should have been, given worries about the economy and those headwinds. But a lot of those headwinds, you guys, was the fact that Trump was actually seen as really good on the economy, and a quote unquote unknown or normal Republican would come in not as well defined. And Democrats would have had a better chance to define that person, kind of like we saw happen to Mitt Romney in 2012, right? They were able to define him on their terms, the Obama campaign was. But one other thing I want to follow up on, Patrick, is this issue of abortion. As you said, it was her strongest issue throughout all of our polling. And we did see that, again, among undecided voters, so many of them did define themselves as pro-choice, but it wasn't the salient issue in the way we saw in 2022. So what does this tell us, not just about this campaign, but also what it means going forward about how this issue is going to play out?
Yeah. Like I said, it was not voters' top issue for their choice for president, to be clear. I do think that this remains a very important and salient issue, though it may be one that is more salient in the near future, at least at the state level. Abortion rights ballots passed in seven states, including some deep red states like Missouri and swing states that Trump won, like Arizona and Nevada. So this did not reflect voters deciding they're no longer pro-choice. But again, I think one reason I love the polling that we did together is we really focused on trying to understand the underlying dynamics and how voters were thinking about issues in more complex ways than just like, are you pro-choice or not? And look, as a Democrat, I think this is BS, but Trump was running on the idea that he was not actually against abortion, but that he was for returning the issue to the states. And again, we asked voters in our poll, how do you feel about that? Just 36% said they thought that that was too restrictive of an idea on abortion in the country. 51% of voters said that they thought, that is actually the right approach. I strongly disagree with that personally, but that is a reality that we need to reckon with as Democrats. Again, I think voters are focused on their own lives. So people are comfortable with the idea that states are going to decide if they feel like their state is going to protect abortion for them and where they live. They're not particularly concerned that abortion is not going to be legal for other people elsewhere. So I don't think it works as well as a federal issue or certainly as a presidential issue. Now, that may change depending on what Congress does. I think Republicans could absolutely overstep on this front and turn this into an effective federal elections topic for Democrats again. I also just think Trump was a particularly difficult Republican to land this message with. I think, Amy, you and I have talked about this. He doesn't come across as the type of guy who really strongly personally opposes abortion. And if I'm being honest, and this is probably too candid, I don't believe that Trump personally cares about abortion. I think there's a lot of parallels to how the dynamic with Obama in 2008 and same-sex marriage, where he said, I'm not in favor of it. And everyone, and Democrats, myself included, just winked back, we know. And I think that there's some feeling among center-right people who were able to, support Trump despite being pro-choice themselves, because they don't actually think he really cares about this that much. And on top of it all, Roe v. Wade wasn't overturned while he was in office. It happened while Biden was in office. And certainly I know there's been reporting on young people finding that confusing and some voters, particularly low information voters, believing Biden was to blame for Roe v. Wade disappearing. And the last thing I'll say on this is I think there's very little faith in Washington's ability to solve big problems. So the idea that electing Democrats was going to restore Roe v. Wade protections across the country, I think was just something that many people didn't believe. Even if they agree more with Democrats on this issue, I don't know how much faith there was that Democrats were going to be able to deliver on it.
The fight is literally in the states, as Trump has made clear.
Yeah, that's where it's going to happen, and that's going to continue to happen. I don't think this issue is settled. I think the success of abortion rights ballots, including in some very deep red places, I know there were a couple that lost in places like South Dakota this cycle. I don't think that's going to deter advocates, given the overall results, from pushing forward an agenda. And I think Republicans, if they do make efforts to actually outlaw abortion across the country, rather than allow states to make those decisions, that's how this becomes a federal issue for them again. And that's how Democrats would be able to leverage this issue. So I hope for the sake of women that they don't do that, and they would be wise to avoid doing that if they want to protect their position.
Obviously, we all wish we had done a late October poll to measure what we found in May and August and September against that. But it does seem like the snap election had a couple different phases, and Kamala Harris had a pretty good rollout and favorable August and September between the debate and a Fed rate cut. But then October just felt different. And when we look at our September survey, in that phase, by 50 to 38, voters viewed Trump as more extreme than Harris, with 8% saying they were equally extreme. But then looking at the national exit poll, more voters viewed Trump than Harris as too extreme, but it was just by a 45 to 39 margin. What do you think was the biggest driver of that? Do you think it was Trump's paid advertising, particularly on transgender, on some of the past comments that Harris had made back in 2019 and 2020? And I'd love both of your thoughts on the extent to which Harris should have played more defense to try and counter the messaging she was facing in these battleground states.
I'll take a first stab at that. First, I don't think she played defense, and I don't think she played offense. I think she played dead in the water. And I think that was a big challenge for her campaign. But a critical moment in the campaign for me, watching it, looking back at it, and there's a great article about this in The Atlantic, was the time immediately after Harris became the nominee, and Donald Trump personally melted down. His campaign, however, stayed on message and really, went into overdrive on their TV advertising. And those of us who've done campaigns know how difficult it is that when your candidate is off the rails, to actually get the campaign moving in the right direction when that occurs is immensely challenging. And so to your point, David, I thought the Trump campaign did an amazingly awesome job at defining her as too liberal, too out of touch, big government, wrong type of Democrat. I think all the issues that they used kind of played an us against them, immigration, for example, but also the transgender issue that you mentioned. And I really think that they depositioned her out of the center of the electorate in a way that made it very difficult for her to recover.
What really happened there is that Trump was able to convince just enough people, 5% in this case, that he wasn't more extreme than her, and get people to see them more in the middle. I think the immigration messaging certainly resonated. And again, we saw early on that immigration was voters' number two issue, and a majority of voters said it was one of their top three issues. I think that messaging was particularly effective for Trump. But again, I think it really came down to the economy in a lot of ways towards the end, and the feeling that that sort of momentum people were feeling in September, that things maybe were actually getting better, that there were interest rate cuts, that some unease started to return as we got closer to November. And I think a lot of what some of those voters are saying is, I don't think he's so extreme that he's unacceptable to me on the economy and on the issues where I already know I do like and trust him. And I'm no longer going to just call him an extremist just because I kind of do want him to lead on some other fronts where I'm more comfortable with Trump's positions. So I think he helped deposition her with the center. We know that there are folks who have concerns about immigration and some issues are, around transgender policy. We also know that there are Democrats like Andy Beshear who have won in very red places while not shying away from those issues themselves. So again, I think it's a little bit more about the economy than those issues themselves, but certainly I don't think they helped.
But do either of you think that it would have made a difference had she rebutted some of those lines of attack rather than ignored them on the air?
Yeah, I do think that it was a mistake to ignore those lines of attack. And I think that there were responses available to Harris that would have allowed her to say, no, Trump is now focusing on these small social issues and I am focused on what matters to you. I think for some of the reasons I've talked about already, I think there's deeper problems that the Democrats have. And I don't know how much Harris could overcome some of those deeper issues in terms of trust that we, really care about kitchen table issues. But I think not responding was the worst of all worlds for her. Because one, said to the base and folks on the left that she did still need to turn out and vote for her. And some of those folks did stay home. Like, I'm not actually going to have your back. I'm not going to fight for you. While for the center right, it didn't say like, well, she's not speaking to it, so she must not be that extreme. It's that she's too scared to speak up because she's worried about angering the base whom she's really beholden to. So by not talking about those issues, you end up alienating both camps.
I think that the polarized nature of American politics within the primary electorate, so among Republicans, you know, very conservative, among Democrats, very liberal, creates a situation where you have to take positions, or people believe they need to take positions, that are more extreme than the center of the electorate. And what I thought that the Trump campaign did a brilliant job doing was using her quotes that when she was running for in the primary for president, using her quotes against her. And it's really hard to rebut your own quotes, right? If you're saying one thing and then go out and say, oh, what I said wasn't really true, you look worse. And I thought that on the Democratic side, they did a really good job using abortion quotes against Republicans running in the Senate. So I think the issue wasn't that she should have played defense. I think the issue was that she needed to go on attack, and she didn't. And all of the stuff, that, to the extent that she did some attack, it was a small portion of her overall messaging. And again, she won the debate by going on attack, and they didn't continue that throughout the rest of the campaign. And that was the challenge.
You guys, I want you to talk about, and Greg, I'm going to start with you on this. Two things that we picked up in our polling early on that did end up becoming actually a reality. One was how much better Senate Democrats were doing consistently than the top of the ticket, whether it was Biden or Harris. And also how Republicans were not matching Trump showing in those states. And we noticed that even as the races were tightening as we got into those September polls, Republicans were still underperforming Trump. And of course, what we found is that only one of those purple states ended up that Trump ended up winning also voted for a Republican senator. So Democrats held all of those swing state Senate seats. Greg, what does this tell you about going forward about the coalition, the Trump coalition, and what it means, not just in, I mean, we can talk about the immediate midterm year, but about the kinds of people that Trump brought into the electorate and whether they're going to be available for other Republicans going forward?
Great question. I'm going to make a couple quick points. The three purple states you referenced, all the Democrats outspent the Republicans early, and they used the issue of abortion. And that is a place where abortion actually worked for Democrats. And so I think that those races came back to Republicans late, but the big issue was that they were defined early in a way that didn't allow them to come back, different than like McCormick in Pennsylvania, for example. So that's one. Two, I think that Republicans need to recognize that the Trump coalition may not be the Republican coalition. Two pieces on that. I remember in 1986, after the Reagan landslide, the Republicans said, hey, we're gonna go turn out these, you know, Reagan Democrats, and they targeted races in the South. And what they ended up doing is turning out a bunch of Democrats that went on to vote for Democrats. And they didn't come back in the Senate. Similar thing happened in 2018 in the special elections after Trump won. Republicans came out and said they were going to repeal Obamacare, and the electorate completely changed on them. And one of the things that I'd be very concerned about right now, if I was Donald Trump and his political team, is they've created all these special elections for Congress. And if they do something here in the first 3-4 months of the year that triggers a negative reaction inside the electorate, they could like lose a bunch of seats that they thought they were going to win and be in a position, you know, where now they might even lose the majority in the House. So I think that the idea that the, you know, I'm already seeing when I'm looking at issues that all the clients are like, hey, let's look at all these issues and see what's going on with the Trump coalition, where young Black males, for example, that completely not with the Republicans on a lot of the issues. And so I think that Republicans, and there's a big split between Hispanic men and women, Hispanic men looking much more like Republicans, Hispanic women looking much more like Democrats, that they may not be able to repeat that Trump coalition on either an electoral standpoint or an issue standpoint.
Great points there. And Patrick, what about from looking at the Democratic side of the ledger here? I mean, again, in some ways, Democrats didn't have as terrible a night as they could have, given the fact that, you know, Trump pretty easily swept those swing states. But it's also clear that the Biden coalition, the Obama coalition that consisted of younger voters and voters of color, just did not turn out for Harris. So on this whole debate about whether these voters are now true toss-up voters, or as Greg kind of alluded to, they may just be Trump voters. Where do you stand on all this? Like, are we really in a time of realignment here? And if so, what do Democrats do going forward?
I think that it is absolutely true that these are Trump voters and not Republican voters. I think what's clear is there is a lot of distrust and dislike of parties and establishment politicians across the board, particularly among young people. So I do think that that is one, that they're quite toss-up voters in an election between a traditional Republican and a traditional Democrat. I think the Democrat is still going to have the edge with younger voters. And to be clear, Democrats won younger voters this election. We just won them by a lot less than we historically have, and by a lot less than we need to. But I think a lot of these voters are more in play because they, again, like voters overall, they don't believe that Democrats, not enough of them believe that Democrats are the party that is going to prioritize their lives and their well-being and their futures, in particular their economic futures. And I think there's significant concern there. The other thing that I think is happening with young people in particular, and is something that needs to be researched and better understood, I think there remains significant hangover from COVID and frustration with Democrats, particularly among the youngest cohort of young voters, like 18 to 24-year-olds, about how Democrats handled COVID and our association with restrictions that really upended their lives. I was conducting focus groups throughout the fall, really across a wide range of states with young people. These were not focus groups particularly about this election. It's more to do with their day-to-day lives and experiences. And what came up over and over again was how much sorrow and anger there is that people feel like some important years of their lives were just stolen from them. I think that created sort of a similar dynamic of like, do Democrats have the right priorities? Do they really care about me and my life and what matters most to me? And that's one reason why we saw a 9-point drop off between how Biden did in 2020 among 18 to 24-year-olds and this new crop of 18 to 24-year-olds, who many of whom were still in high school at the time and living with severe restrictions and unable to see their friends this time around.
I would just add one thing, Amy. I do think that there's a real opportunity for the Republican Party with Hispanics near and long term, and that's been kind of percolating for the last 3 or 4 election cycles. And I think it's a real challenge to the Democrats because they're in trouble or at risk becoming a two-legged stool of just white liberals and African Americans. And so, you know, that's something I think you'll see a giant fight between the Republicans and the Democrats here coming up on how to keep the Hispanic support.
Thank you, Patrick. Thanks, Greg, as well. David, thank you. I was really excited to have this conversation. We could keep going on it, especially thinking about 2026. We have to end it here. I also want to thank everybody who tuned in for joining us today. If you are a subscriber to the Cook Political Report, in the weeks ahead, keep your eyes on your inbox, your email inbox, for our weekly Cook Political Report columns, as well as announcements for upcoming briefings. In January, we're going to have a curtain raiser for our Senate and governor's races. Remember, we've got two big governor's races coming up in 2025 in Virginia and in New Jersey. In February, we'll walk through the battle for the House. That's right, you guys. This narrow of a margin, midterm year. Take a look at what seats there we'll be paying attention to. And in March, David and I will discuss the 2025 Cook PVI. I think we're going on, right? Is this year 30, Dave? Year 25 of the PVI? Where is the time gone? If you're not a subscriber and would like to be, especially after hearing all of this and what's coming up, you can just go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Again, thank you all for joining us, and we will see you all soon.